A class by His Holiness Devaramita Swami on Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th canto, 1st chapter, texts 4 to 7, given on the 8th of November 2015 in Sydney, Australia.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th canto, chapter 1, the Manus, administrators of the universe, texts 4 through 7. Shri Rishi Uvacha Manamosmin Vitita Shat Ope Swayambhuvadaya Ajaste Katito Yatra Devadinam Chasambhava. Shukadev Goswami said, in the previous kalpa, there have already been six manus. In the present kalpa, there have already been six manus. I have described to you Swayambhuva Manu and the appearance of many demigods. In this kalpa of Brahma, Swayambhuva is the first Manu. Swayambhuva had two daughters named Akuti and Devahuti. From their wombs, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as two sons named Yajnamurti and Kapila, respectively. These sons were entrusted with preaching about religion and knowledge. Purport. Devahuti's son was known as Kapila, and Akuti's son was known as Yajnamurti. Both of them taught about religion and philosophical knowledge. O best of the Kurus, I've already described in the third canto the activities of Kapila, the son of Devahuti. Now I shall describe the activities of Yajnapati, the son of Akuti. Swayambhuva Manu, the husband of Shatarupa, was by nature not at all attached to the enjoyment of the senses. Thus he gave up his kingdom of sense enjoyment and entered the forest with his wife to practice austerities. Purport. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, evam parampara praptam imam raja shayo vidhu, the supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession. And the saintly kings understood it in that way. All the Manus were perfect kings. They were Rajarshis. In other words, although they held posts as kings of the world, they were as good as great saints. Swayambhuva Manu, for example, was the emperor of the world, yet he had no desire for sense gratification. This is the meaning of monarchy. The king of the country, or the emperor of the empire, must be so trained that by nature he renounces sense gratification. It is not that because one becomes king, he should unnecessarily spend money for sense gratification. As soon as kings became degraded, spending money for sense gratification, they were lost. Similarly, at the present moment, monarchy having been lost, the people have created democracy, which is also failing. Now, by the laws of nature, the time is coming when dictatorship will put the citizens into more and more difficulty. If the king or dictator individually, or members of the government collectively, cannot maintain the state or kingdom according to the rules of Manu Samhita, certainly their government will not endure. Om Agnanachimadandasya Gyananjana Shlokaya Chokshun Vinitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrimasthi Guru Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Srimad Bhagavatam class is giving you a grand tour of the cosmos and beyond. Where else will you get such an education? Please do not take it for granted just because so much of this information is beyond the range of your current senses. We have to face the facts. That conditioned life means we're contained in a box. The box consists of our own limited mind and senses, and the box also consists of material nature. In that situation, how can you have genuine knowledge? You can't see. It's like someone trying to live their life, going about their ways in the city, and they can only see a half a meter in front of them. And yet, they want to talk about what's around them, how everything looks. Of course, blind persons make their way through the city, but they don't claim to be able to describe how everything looks. And if someone tells them, this is how it looks, the blind person does not immediately challenge. What are you talking about? What do you know? I don't see it. Bhagavatam requires humility. Sometimes devotees wonder, how can we distribute these books on the street? People cannot even pronounce the title. Please, sir, I have a very nice book for you. No, there is the super soul in the heart that is responsible for all remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. We forget that our attempts to understand, our attempts to cognate, our attempts to know are all under the control of the Lord in the heart. We're not independent. Even in our mundane, everyday dealings, we cannot perceive, we cannot observe, we cannot remember, we cannot even forget without the help of the super soul and heart. Therefore, when people are presented with the literary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is not an ordinary event. The super soul and the heart is working with the super soul and the heart of the distributor. And that conspiracy, that out-of-the-world conspiracy, produces inconceivable results. We should never think that we are independent in our knowledge acquisition or our understanding. But that is the tendency of the conditioned soul. I know me. I know what I can understand, believe me. My mind's made up. Don't try to confuse me with the facts. That's conditioned life. We're so sure of ourselves. We're sure that we know what we want. We're sure that we know what is happiness. We're sure that we know what is success, right? And we're hoping that if we take to spiritual life, Krishna will fulfill our puny, mistaken desires. How does Krishna handle all that? It's like a bunch of little children demanding the moon. So Krishna himself says that if a devotee approaches him with such childish desires, meaning material desires, he will fulfill them in such a way that you'll never ask for that again. Be careful what you wish for. But Krishna is not intending to crush you. He's fulfilling your desires in a way that material nature cannot. Material nature just pretends to fulfill your desires. It offers you the hope of desire fulfillment. I've explained so many times our craziness. We think that there's one thing known as desire, and there's another thing known as fulfillment, and they must come together. Because what's the use of having a desire without fulfillment? So we look at our life and we think we've got a pretty good chance to fulfill some desires, right? Not all. We're modest. We're humble. We're not going to fulfill 100%. But what do you think? 50%? That's good enough. Because we have this instinctive conditioned tendency to think that because I have a desire, it must be fulfilled. And that madness is combined with another craziness in which we think the purpose of the material world is to fulfill my desires to some degree. The purpose of this world is to allow me to enjoy at least something. That's the purpose of the world. And we immediately pacify ourselves by saying, you know, I'm not greedy, I'm not lusty, I don't want everything, just something, you know. There's a lot of people in this world who are far worse than me. They are greedy, they are lusty. But me, I have reasonable desires. And then, of course, you talk to your friends about it, and they all agree, yeah, you're all right, you're right. That's why they're your friends. No, you're not bad. What you want is reasonable. Your desires are normal. We've made a mistake about desire, fulfillment, and the material world. The nature of the material world is illusory. We read that all the time. It's run by Krishna's illusory energy. It is Krishna's illusory energy. The purpose is to trick you. And we cannot accept that. We think we're just too shrewd. We're too smart. We've got street smarts. No way we're going to be cheated. But that is the purpose of the illusory energy. And Krishna warns you about it. But we don't believe it. We don't believe it. Or if we partially believe it, we think, anyway, Krishna, I've got to learn through experience because that's the best teacher. When I learn through experience, I'll never forget it. But material experience causes forgetfulness because that is the nature of the material energy. Contact with it causes the spirit soul to become covered and bewildered. So I've explained several times. You're turning to the illusory energy and saying, please educate me through experience. Good luck. The purpose of the illusory energy is to beat you on the head in such a way that you never figure out what's going on. So where's the education? Where's the learning by experience? You continue birth after birth after birth. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, mudha janmani janmani. Birth after birth, you're a fool. Because you never learn the underlying riddle. You never solve it. That material desires cannot be fulfilled. This is why people take birth after birth. Because this idea that there's some things I've got to do before I die. I've got to get it out of my system. Materially, that doesn't work. Materially, it doesn't work. Because the desires are always unfulfilled, you must take another birth. You see how the trap works. The illusory energy promises you, just do this, get it out of your system, come on, everyone's doing it, you're going to be all right. You'll finally be peaceful afterwards. No. The desire simply becomes worse. So just think. The nature of the setup. Desire, fulfillment. They are not one thing. But we, in our mind, compress them into one. Because I have this desire, there must be fulfillment. It makes so much sense, doesn't it? It's so logical. Desire, fulfillment. They're two birds on the same tree. We've got our own version of the Upanishads. What is it? The Katha Upanishad. Dwa Suparna Sayuja Sakaya. There are two birds on the tree. One is the eating bird, the other is the witnessing bird. Well, we got our own version. There are two birds on the tree, and they love each other. Desire and fulfillment. There's another example about the birds on the tree that I give when I'm speaking at universities. There are two birds on the tree. One's called more, and the other's called better. They love each other. The more you get, the better everything is. The more bird, the better bird. What a combination. But recently, even mundane scholars and social researchers have realized that something extraordinary has happened. The more bird is still on the tree, because everyone's trying to hit more and more, but the bird known as better has flown away. People are starting to wake up that just because I have more, my life is not qualitatively better. As measured by psychological indicators. They're starting to realize that. But what can they do about it? The idea of simple living is becoming very popular amongst a certain percentage of the population. You've got to declutter your life, clean out your inbox, clean out your house, simplify. live in a more uncluttered way so that you can have more peace of mind. That idea is starting to make its rounds. But what does it actually lead to? Because people have no knowledge about what is beyond the material plane. When they say, declutter my life, clean out my flat, that means I have to buy other things that are more simple. So I get rid of some things and I buy more things, which are known as part of the simple living regimen, lifestyle. So it's all arrangement on the material plane. I get rid of those complex things, I buy more things that are known as simple. No one knows how to go to another level because they lack the proper knowledge. Bhagavatam is teaching us, desires over here, material fulfillments over there, they only pretend to come together. It's always... In our mind, we hallucinate the connection. Oh, I see it now. Yeah. Birth after birth, that happens. We're so prone to being bewildered. So Bhagavatam is meant to educate us. What is the nature of the material energy? And what is the nature of the spiritual energy? So just think what's happening in Bhagavatam class. You're sitting on the floor, you're not sitting in any plush chairs. Although Srila Prabhupada was insisting when the present Los Angeles temple was purchased. It used to be a church. And when the devotees bought it, the church, the main room, had church chairs in it, you know, called pews. And so Prabhupada told the devotees, don't take the church chairs out. I want it so that visitors can come and sit down and be comfortable and hear lectures on the Bhagavatam. But the devotees knew better. They knew, Prabhupada, we're Hare Krishnas. Hare Krishnas mean we do everything on the floor. We sit on the floor, we eat on the floor, we sleep on the floor. Hare Krishna. That's the way it was back then in the early 70s. So, even though Prabhupada told them, keep the chairs in, he even told them, keep the organ there. And while he was there, one devotee got on the organ and was playing the Hare Krishna mantra. The Prabhupada said to keep the organ there. So, then what happened? Prabhupada left, and the devotees took out the chairs, took out the organ. So when Prabhupada returned, he saw that they had taken it all out. And an eyewitness told me what happened. The leader of the Los Angeles community then was in Prabhupada's room, and Prabhupada was just smoking him. He was scorching him. Why did you take the chairs out? Why did you take the organ out? The devotee was, you know, on his knees, you know, begging Prabhupada for forgiveness. And meanwhile, the devotee was backing out the door on his knees, like, oh, sorry, Prabhupada, come back here. This is another aspect of Srila Prabhupada's compassion. As spiritual master, he's correcting his disciple. That's part of love. Just like when a child corrects, when a parent corrects the child. So, we're sitting on the floor, yet we're hearing the most sublime knowledge. And how does it all begin? We chant Jai Radha Madhava. This is the most intimate song about the topmost portion of the spiritual world. You've got it all in that song. The perfect scene is given to you, and you sing it every morning. This is Prabhupada's way of inserting into everyone's standard program the most intimate mellows and tastes of bhakti. But he's done it in a way that you can't make offense. He's put it in there. And then one day you start to realize, hey, what am I singing about? Jai Radha Madhava, Kunja Bihari, Gopi Jana Balava, Kirabai Dai. What's going on there? So there you are, singing to start the class. You're singing about the topmost planet in the spiritual world, Krishna Loka, Goloka Vrindavan, and Krishna's personal affairs. His romantic affairs, his parental affairs. You're singing about it all. And then you chant Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You're appealing to Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vasudeva also means the all-pervading. But just to make the point that the all-pervading is also a person, we chant Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So from the very beginning, Bhagavatam is announcing it's taking you beyond the all-pervading oneness. Indeed, that all-pervading oneness is simply the energy, the effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So now, in the eighth canto, we're hearing about the Manus, the directors, the managers of the universe. Who here has ever met a Manu? Who here has ever experienced what you're reading about? So the tendency of the conditioned mind is to think, well, this is kind of inspirational, but I don't know if it's factual, because I haven't seen it. No one I know in my family or my friends have seen it, so maybe we should just take it as an instructional myth. Those of you who have read Searching for Vedic India may remember I explain how the logic goes. In previous decades, like say in the beginning of the 20th century, myth was looked down upon. The histories and narrations in the Bhagavatam were considered just Hindu debauchery. That's a symptom of the mad Hindu mind. That's what the British, they spread that propaganda. They actually hired scholars to produce the best defamations of the Vedas. The one who produced the best one, he got a financial reward. That's why, even at Oxford University today, they have the Bowdoin Chair of Sanskrit. That Bowdoin Chair was funded way back in the 1800s by a Colonel Bowdoin, who said, I'm going to fund a special chair at Oxford for dismantling the Indian people's attachment for their Shastras. So it's still there today, the Bowdoin Chair of Sanskrit. So that was the previous strategy, to demonize myth. This madness, how could you believe it? The next verse you're going to hear is, after Swayambhuva Manu had thus entered the forest with his wife. First of all, what's he doing going into the forest with his wife in old age? Come on. Old age means an old folks home, right? What do you call it? Assisted care facility? Or, if your children are generous, the children may say, move in with us. But in the Western world, usually the parents don't want to move in with the children when the parents are old, because, we respect the children's independence. We don't want to interfere with their enjoyment. Yet, here we see Swayambhuva Manu and his wife, Shatarupa. At the last stage of their life, they've retired. They've left the kingdom, and they've entered the forest. We were explaining last night. Where was that?
Wentworthville.
Yes. How in Vedic times, all the cities had forests surrounding them, and those forests surrounding the cities were especially meant for vanaprastas. So that was the social security program. When you were an elderly couple, you could just go to the forest outside the city. There are forests especially meant for retired couples where you could live in the forest. So now you're hearing Swayambhuva Manu enters the forest with his wife. He stood on one leg on the bank of the river Sunanda. And in this way, with only one leg touching the earth, he performed great austerities for 100 years. While performing these austerities, he spoke as follows. So then you're going to hear the knowledge that Swayambhuva Manu is giving while standing on one leg, performing great austerities. So, the nature of the conditioned mind is to just rebel against this. I can't accept that. So as I said, maybe 100 years ago, even less, maybe 50 years ago, this would have been demonized as primitive tribal myth. What intelligent, rational person could accept this? Now, sometime around 1980 or 90, everything changed. It became more liberal, more accepting. Yes, these are myths, but these Hindu myths have such instructional value. They help your intuition. They open up your creativity. We shouldn't just look down upon myth and reject it. We should accept the myths as being able to open our chakras and give us insights, perennial insights from deep, remote antiquity. But it's still a myth, of course. Now, what are you going to do about that? Especially in Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna say in the first verse of the fourth chapter? Imam Bhavasute Yogam Proktaban Amabhyam. I spoke this knowledge to whom, first of all? The chief executive of the sun planet? And then what? Translation, please. He only knows the Sanskrit. Yes? Vivaswan spoke it to his son Manu. Now, is Krishna just speaking mythology? What do you think? He spoke to the chief executive who lives on the sun planet? Think about it. The wisdom, the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam is out of this world in terms of it's beyond the sense verification by ordinary senses, by ordinary people. But by hearing it, especially by hearing it while performing devotional service, the knowledge is awakened within you. We're singing every morning, at least those who are there for Prabhupada's Guru Puja, Divya Gyan Hriday Prakashito. The divine knowledge is made manifest within me. Srila Prabhupada once explained in Mumbai in 1977 at the Juhu Temple, speaking after his Guru Puja, he said that this Guru Puja is not simply some ritual, it is the transmission of Divya Gyan. By participating in it, by glorifying the representative of Vyasadeva, the knowledge is awakened within you. This is why you see so many older devotees feeling secure and established in bhakti, because Divya Gyan Hriday Prakashita. The knowledge has awakened within them that desire and material fulfillment never connect. That's been awakened within them. The affinity for hearing about Krishna and his pastimes, that's been awakened within them. The rapid intuition that material knowledge is utterly deficient, that has all been awakened within them. So it's not that we are blindly following. It's simply that we have a different kind of science. I explained so many times when speaking at universities that bhakti is not about belief. All the students are astonished, especially the Indian students. They think, what do you mean it's not belief? When I was little, my grandmother read me Mahabharata. Nice beliefs. It's our beliefs. It's beliefs from our culture. No beliefs. It's all about a different way of knowing. A way of knowing that depends on the purity of the lifestyle. We are following the four rules, the regular principles of freedom. Number one, to avoid karmic reactions, horrible karmic reactions. Number two, if we take an initiation, we don't want our Guru Maharaj to get reactions for our nonsense. And number three, by following the four regular principles, you become a human being and you can begin to understand transcendental knowledge. Your lifestyle has changed, therefore you can understand. So now you're very eager to sit on the floor with a little thin mat and hear about Swayambhuva Manu. And he was emperor with powers far beyond what we could consider these days. These days, if someone is mayor and they can successfully run a city, he's practically worshipped. The mayor of Sydney or the mayor of New York made it so that the business opportunities increased or the schools got slightly better. Wow, how cool. That's the standard in Kali Yuga. So we can never conceive that someone could be the emperor of the universe. We can't even accept that Prince Maharaj is emperor of the whole world. No one person can do that. Come on, come on. But just think what the Bhagavatam personalities considered when they heard Shukadeva Goswami explain what was coming in Kali Yuga. You could just see Prince Maharaj and the others saying, that's unbelievable. The people will be that dumb. You gotta be, this is a myth. No one can be that stupid. So everything depends on your position in terms of what you're observing and what you think is important, what you think is a priority. Krishna says in the beginning of the fourth chapter of the Gita, I spoke to the chief executive of the sun planet. And then it came down to Madhu. Right then and there, we're given the ability to understand the purpose of life in this world. It is not to enjoy. It is to get the best knowledge, change your life, and become free from the clutches of Maya. So this is our disagreement with society. This is the line that causes people to be on one side or the other. And you can't erase that line. We do not accept that the purpose of this world is to enjoy. We accept that the purpose of this world is to get the best knowledge, transform your life, and become free from the illusory energy. So this difference is always going to be there. That's why Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, Dvabhuta Sarva Lokesmin Daiva Asuravacha. Two classes of persons have always been there since the beginning of the universe. One thinks God gave us these bodies to enjoy. If they do at all acknowledge God, they know he gave us the bodies to enjoy. He gave us the world to enjoy. He gave us the animals to gobble up. Praise the Lord. And then the other class understands this human body especially is a chance for getting proper knowledge, reforming the lifestyle, and becoming free of illusion and going back to God. So that's the way it is. This is real sociology. This division is always going to be there. Manu's purpose is to administrate the universe so that people make spiritual advancement. Obviously, that purpose has been lost in terms of governments today. And therefore, although it may seem like the people are making progress, they're actually going backwards in terms of the ultimate goal of life. So we shouldn't allow ourselves to be blinded by technological advancement, especially when that advancement is always shown to cause problems simultaneously. This is the way the material energy works. It lets you take one step forward, but there's always a back step. But you just focus on the one step forward, then, hey, why did that back step happen? Hey, what's going on here? Yes, we're making progress, but we got a lot of problems. But one day we'll just have pure progress. Forget it. Yesterday at Wentworthville, we were talking about problems that scientists and ethical philosophers see coming due to self-driving cars. I was talking about with Pratapa and Prabhu also. You're in a self-driving car. They're already happening, you know, on the Google campus in California. I think they may even go in the right in the neighboring city also. So you're in your self-driving car. It senses that you're about to collide with a van of 10 persons. The car, the self-driving car, can make a decision to avoid colliding with the van of 10 persons and killing all 10 persons while you are safe in your car. The car can choose to crash into the sidewall and kill you, but save the 10 persons in the van. Now, who is going to program the car to make such a decision? And you are going to buy that car. So you, as the consumer, have to choose. Do I want a car programmed that when an auto crash comes, the car makes a move to save the most persons, even though I may die? Or do I want to buy a car that's programmed that saves my life no matter what? What to do? This is a real problem. People were surveyed, and most of the people said that they would want the car program to avoid killing the 10 people in the van, but they didn't want to be in the car. And when they were asked, but suppose you were in that self-driving car and the 10 persons were in the other van, what would you do? Most persons couldn't answer. As long as they weren't in the car, they say, no, let the person in that car die to save the 10 other persons in the van. But when it was put to them, but suppose you were actually in that car. So these are real problems of technological advancement. What is our response? We say that the underlying problem is no one knows what to do with their life anyway. We are all for health and longevity. But more important than that is that people actually know the purpose of the human form of life. And what is Shukadev Goswami's verdict? Kim pramatasya bahupi parokshaya vairanaya. Second canto, first chapter. What is the value of a long life? Huh? What is Shukadev Goswami talking about? He says, what's the value of a long life if it's simply wasted by inexperience due to lack of transcendental knowledge? Better to have a short life in which there are at least a few moments of self-realization and enlightenment. So this is the Bhagavatam's point of view. Rather than put all your energy into worrying whose lives we should save, why not try to understand what the purpose of life is? And even if your life is short, if you understand the purpose, you can be a complete success. But even if your life is long and you don't know the purpose of that long life, you've lost everything. So the Bhagavatam is totally re-educating us, transforming our vision. And gradually, in the most amazing way, even the newest devotees, the newest bhakti practitioners, they develop an affinity for hearing about Swayambhu Gamanu and these inconceivable personalities. You start to have respect. They know more than me. Let's hear what they have to say. You're benefiting from the knowledge they give. So when you hear Swayambhu Gamanu describe the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you have an affinity for it. Yes, this is the most intelligent thing I've ever heard. Because the Manus are far more intelligent than any human being today. And Lord Brahma is Adi Kavi, the original intellectual of the universe. So the Bhagavatam is training you up to understand that human beings today are quite dumb. And not a lot of people can handle that, you know? They think they're the crown of creation. Meanwhile, they're destroying their own habitat. So the Bhagavatam will take the scales off your eyes so you can actually see. And yes, you'll develop an affinity for hearing from Swayambhuvamanu, hearing from Shukadev Goswami, hearing from Prichit Maharaj. It happens. Your reality changes. You develop other senses. You're not just groping in the dark with material senses. You develop spiritual senses. In fact, those spiritual senses are already part of you, the spirit soul. But they've just been artificially covered by material senses. So, in conclusion, bhakti yoga is the process of reviving your real senses. With real senses, you can understand what is real sense gratification. It's very humbling to admit that you don't know what real sense gratification is. We are not opposed to sense gratification, by the way. Did you know that? We're not opposed to sense gratification. But the question is, whose senses should be gratified? Oh. We want all the gratification for Krishna's senses. But what about me? Hey, that's not fair. We should at least share with Krishna, you know, 50%, you know, 50-50, you know. Now, because we are part of Krishna, when Krishna enjoys automatically, we enjoy. Indirectly, we are indirect enjoyers. Krishna is the only direct enjoyer. So the bhakti process brings us to that conclusion, and then we can be peaceful. As long as we think we are the direct enjoyer, we'll never be peaceful, and there'll never be world peace. So let us put ourselves firmly in the hands of this Bhagavatam process. We are being put in touch with wisdom far beyond what people understand as knowledge today. And the Bhagavatam wisdom is allowing us to develop a wisdom culture in which it is fun to strive for the ultimate goal of life. It is enjoyable to give enjoyment to Krishna. That is real life.